Welcome to Focus on the Community, produced by DLC Media News Center. I'm Kevin Rader, sitting in for the vacationing Dave Crooks. And with me today, we have a young man who's made quite a name for himself in the political circles, Mark Lauder, the former director of strategic communications for the Trump campaign in 2020. He also worked for Vice President Pence, both while campaigning and then after when he became vice president. And now he's the chief communications officer for America First Policy Institute. Mark, you've just moved from Florida back to D.C., and I questioned it when you told me you did, but you did it.
Yeah, you know, but I'm still a Hoosier at heart, born and raised, and still struggling with the NCAA tournament from a few weeks ago. So, Kevin, it's, you know, after the 2020 election, I left politics for a year, went to work in Florida for a great group of people that were working on hospital issues down there. But even though I loved the weather and my improved golf game, I couldn't even open up my social media or turn on the television without just getting frustrated about the current state of our country, where things were going. And so when the opportunity came to join America First Policy Institute, which is basically a think tank that is led by six former cabinet secretaries in the Trump administration, eight senior White House officials, I couldn't pass it up. I needed to get back in because the moment's too important.
And when you talk,
that we face coming up in 22 and 24.
Well, that's where I was going to go. Yeah, with the off year elections, certainly are huge. We can get into that more a little later. I'm leaning toward the 2024 because obviously, if you're gearing back up, I would have to assume that means that your former boss, President Trump, former President Trump, is doing the same.
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, obviously, I know he is very supportive of the of our work. We are technically a C3, so we are a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank, much similar, you know, very similar to Heritage or some of the other conservative groups out there. But this is really focused on the America First policies. And I was talking about this when I was down at CPAC a few weeks ago. And another radio program had asked me about, you know, why America First. And I said, you know, I'm old enough to remember, even though you still call me a young man, I'm old enough to remember, you know, in 1980 when Ronald Reagan was elected and they were called Reagan Democrats. And they reelected them in 84. They wanted to keep the good times rolling in 88. But then, you know, we had a blip in the economy, some questionable campaign decisions, and a guy who came along and said, I'll feel your pain. And they went back to being Democrats. And it ended that revolution. And that's because I think they never made the transition from voting for the man and voting for the policies and the things that he was fighting for. So regardless of whether, you know, it is Donald Trump running in 2024 or if his name's even on the ballot, which it won't be in 22 or in 26 or probably in 28, I think you can still fight for the policies that he was fighting for by putting the thought process, the academic research, the vigor that is needed. So whether you're running for City Hall, the State House, or the White House, you can get online, see our 21 different policy centers, see the academic research, see the policy thought process, and then obviously if you want to run on an America First type of an agenda, you've got the backup to do it.
Will the decision that he makes really be decided in the off-year elections?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would think that, you know, and again, obviously my other former boss, you know, Vice President Pence, thinks the same way, is that we've got to be focused only on one thing right now, and that's 2022. Because 2024, it will get there, but we've got to retake the House, retake the Senate, and that's the first step. And then, obviously, after that happens, you know, it wouldn't surprise me at this time next year and going in through those early summer months, that's when you would actually start to formally launch your campaign for the White House. But it is a process, and you have to do all of the basic blocking and tackling right now, which is getting Republicans, conservatives elected up and down the ballot in 22. Build your framework. Obviously, there's fundraising involved. And then once you take that step, then you look at the playing field and decide whether or not this is your time to throw your hat in the ring.
Look into your crystal ball, because when you get through the primaries, you're kind of sitting there straddling two worlds. If both the former vice president and the former president enter the fray.
No, absolutely. And really, I mean, that's what so many of these primaries come down to, is, you know, and then obviously being able to unite at the end, you know, to take on that general election. And it'll be very interesting to see how the field shapes up. I mean, obviously, there are a lot of names that are being bandied about, of course, including the former president and the former vice president. But there are also many others. And the question is going to be is that, you know, did you do the things that you needed to do in 21 and in early 22 before we even get to 23 and 24? And in many cases, you see a lot of those top names that are doing those things. They're hosting the fundraisers for congressional and Senate candidates or incumbents. They're going to those early battleground states. They're starting to build their team out, starting to lay the groundwork for what their campaign is going to be about. But then it's also likely to change between now and then, and the field will change between now and then. And, you know, a year ago, we wouldn't have been saying that foreign policy probably would not have been among the top issues, you know, in an upcoming campaign. And here we are today, you know, and I have the luxury of sitting in an office right next door to Lieutenant General Keith Kellogg, who served as the vice president's national security advisor, who was a top Security Council member for President Trump. And we're sitting about talking about, you know, are we entering a new variation of the old Cold War?
Yeah, you do have to wonder that. Mark, thinking historically here, when I just heard you say America First, it just rang the bell with me in history during World War II, I believe, when America First was not necessarily a positive connotation at the time. It was seen as though folks that didn't want to really get the job done in World War II. Have you thought about that?
We have thought about that. In fact, we're actually going to be putting out a lot more information about that here in the next couple of weeks, because, and it was true during the Trump White House, obviously the vice president, I traveled around the world with him when he was vice president. America First in the Trump administration, and I think what we stand for today, does not mean America alone. It never has. But what we have to start doing is having those difficult conversations of saying, you know, what is in America? What is America's foreign policy strategic goal? What are our interests there? How can we play a role? But that doesn't always mean just putting our troops on the ground somewhere. You know, I mean, the president was very clear, and so many others, you know, that we need to stop, you know, spilling American blood in these endless wars where there is no strategic path to victory. Or there's no clear reason in terms of America's interest in doing this. And so we can lay that out. But I think, you know, one of the key elements of it is that, you know, we are obviously the lone remaining superpower in the world. It doesn't mean we're the only power. So we need to build up alliances. But we also need allies that are doing the thing, that are thinking strategically as well. You know, America First also said to Germany, your investment in Nord Stream 2, your close connections and energy dependence on Russia is putting you at a strategic disadvantage and is also impacting our ability as America to deal with international challenges. And now here we are 5 years, 4 years later, and we're playing that out. And now you see Germany listening to the advice that we gave them years ago that said you cannot become energy dependent upon Russia. Or any of really of Europe should not be doing that. And so, you know, sometimes it means having difficult conversations with our friends, not just difficult conversations with our adversaries.
Since you work in communications, I'm talking with Mark Lauder with the America First Policy Institute. Mark, I'm going to go over a couple of messagings here that I see for both Republicans and Democrats, and then you can just pick up with it. Let's start with Republicans. I see the highest rated show on Fox being carried in Russia. A party whose standard bearer is asking Putin for favors while he obviously massacres Ukraine. From the Democrat side, I see President Biden dealing with COVID and confronting war and inflation. And yet, as you know, overwhelmed as any president may be with all those at one time, but then losing the battle with public confidence with only about 40% on a good day. So as I look at the messages on both these two parties, I don't see very much positive right now.
No, and I think in those areas I would agree with you, and you know, I think many people have made it very clear that, you know, that we stand, you know, united against what Vladimir Putin is doing in Russia, and we need to focus our attention on what we can do to help Ukraine. You know, General Kellogg was telling me just the other day, he's like, you know, obviously America can make sure that the MiG-29s, to use the example, can get to Ukraine. We can backfill them through our allies. We can also make sure that they have the S-300 anti-aircraft missile systems and backfill them with Patriots. You know, these are the things that President Zelensky wants. We can work with our allies to do it if we show the leadership to get it done, which is something that is lacking right now. But I think the one big difference, and I was saying this just yesterday to some of my colleagues here, that when I look ahead to 2022 and beyond to 2024, typically, and you know this so well, Kevin, you know, typically when you're on the outside of power, you're the challenger candidate, so to speak, you are having to convince people that your plan, your agenda, your policy proposals, you know, hypothetically will solve the issues that matter to voters, and your success or failure in that campaign is basically on whether you can make that connection. The good thing, I think, that Republicans, conservatives have in this upcoming cycle is we don't have to convince the American people. All they have to do is remember a couple of years ago when we weren't paying $4.25 a gallon for gas, or when, you know, we were dealing with out of control inflation, or when, you know, we weren't having Russia invading, you know, other countries or those kinds of things. And so in time after time and time, we can go to the policies. I don't think it's going to be that difficult of a connection to make with most people to say, you were better off a couple of years ago.
But Mark, you are right now. Couldn't we argue, and I don't know whether this will make sense to the American voter overall, that this message will resonate, but we have inflation because people are spending more money. And obviously, unless they stop spending money, that's going to continue. And so inflation obviously is a problem, but I don't know that you could actually lay it at the lap of, I mean, we had such a desperate economy at the time of COVID that clearly it was going to make a comeback. It's done that and now brought inflation with it. Let me go back on January 6th. Is that the dark cloud hanging over the party, Mark?
It's obviously a dark cloud. It's obviously a dark cloud, and it was a dark day. But I don't think it's going to hang. I don't think it hangs over the party any more than, you know, than the civil unrest and the downtowns that were burning, you know, in the summer of 2020 hangs over, you know, just, you know, the Democrat Party. I think these are dark marks on both houses. But I do think, and I know Vice President Pence said this just a few weeks ago, and I think he's even reiterating it today, is that I think our success is going to be looking forward. We can't relitigate whether it is the 2020 outcome, whether it is the events of January 6th. I think our success as a party is going to be on what is the positive outlook moving forward. And how do we do that? And so I think the candidate that can do that, whether they are, again, running at the local level, state level, or at the federal level, will be the successful one. And I think one of the things that backs that up is that, you know, when you look at 2020, regardless of the outcome at the presidential level, you know, Republicans gained seats in the House of Representatives, where they were expected to lose them. We did not lose state house control or control of governorships anywhere in the nation when many people were expecting that there were going to be major setbacks, especially when you had a different outcome at the top of the ticket. So we fought that historical trend. And then obviously there were the off-year elections last year and in a few special cases where things have really picked up. So I think the message is there. I think the American people see that we can have better days, better outcomes moving forward if we go back to the policies that were already proven to work. We'll confront the issues. We'll have to have honest conversations about some of those other dark times. But I think people are going to be looking to the future rather than the past when they go to the ballot box.
I'm wondering about regime change. There has been some discussion. Biden obviously broached the topic first. Now Russia's following suit, saying there should be regime change here before the next election. I mean, I've never been or watched where a foreign country gets as much positive pub during a time of war in our country than what we have with Russia right now. Does that surprise you?
It does and it doesn't. You know, I mean, I think, and obviously, you know, Kevin, as you well know, I mean, I started my career first 13 years or so in journalism, including, you know, in journalism in Indiana, you know, a couple of different stops. And when I look back at the major conflicts, we didn't really have the, especially like, you know, World War II in those areas. And I don't really count Vietnam in that era because obviously there wasn't that way. But when it was a major global conflict, there really wasn't, you know, we didn't have the level of sophistication of reporting technologies. We didn't obviously have the 24-hour news cycles of multiple outlets. And then obviously with social media, where anyone can pop on and around the world, and obviously, you know, leaders and countries do, to be able to give their side of the story of whatever that story is. So that doesn't surprise me. I think what we're seeing is just kind of an evolution of journalistic coverage abilities. And I think we're also seeing probably a more critical press. And I don't mean that being criticism of the press, but a more critical press that's looking at both sides of an issue rather than just rallying around what would one side would have been, say, you know, during the World War II or earlier efforts. Might be a legacy of maybe Vietnam, where there was obviously much more critical coverage of those kinds of conflicts. So that doesn't surprise me. But what does surprise me is the ability in real time we're seeing where words that are said in one part of the world can be immediately translated and moved out into another part of the world. And that is because of obviously technology and things like that, where that would have taken a lot more time in previous conflicts.
Since you deal with messaging, and recently Indiana Senator Mike Braun made a comment dealing with interracial marriage, you know that Democrats will try to make that say that all Republicans feel the same way. You had to be chagrined when you heard that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no question. And we both do it. Both sides do it. You take either a comment, whether it is out of context or whether it is misconstrued or if it actually was a comment, obviously that was said that, you know, as a firm policy belief, and immediately try to cast the entire opposition party, you know, with that paintbrush. You know, Republicans do it with, you know, the so-called squad. And Democrats do it with, you know, with some of the more, you know, further
Lincoln Project.
Well,
should I say that?
More of, you know, well, you know, but even with the, you know, with the, you know, with certain members of Congress, you know, who have a proclivity of saying some controversial things. And that is unfortunate. And I think it's unfortunate on both sides. But I think it goes back to that old adage, and you know that so well, is that, you know, why do politicians keep doing attack ads? Because they work.
Yeah.
And this, I think, is this is the modern day attack ad, that we know so well from so many campaigns gone by. But now the attack ad is the tweet of the day, or how we can take a tweet, make it go viral, or social media, or through the various social media channels, and take one comment and cast the entire other side. Because, you know, when it's my side of the aisle, if I'm having to explain what one person said, then, you know, I'm not saying about why we think we have the positive vision for the future. And it's constant distraction.
I was thinking about one of the best quotes in politics I've ever heard is 3 reasons not to be a politician. You have to wear your best suit, ask your best friends for money, and now I've forgotten the 3rd. Wear your best suit, ask your best friends for money, and I'll think of it in a minute. But, oh, talk about yourself all the time. Yeah. The 3 reasons why you don't want to be in politics. Will Mike Pence, you've been close enough to him, he obviously talks about how much his religion means to him, and I believe it is very sincere. But as I sit and look at this, the situation he's been in with the former president, I wonder, is he at odds or issue within himself about what master to serve, his God or his president?
No, I don't think he is. And obviously obviously I know as you do too, you know, I mean, he's a man of deep faith. But he's also a man who truly believes, you know, in the Constitution and in the offices that he serves. And while, you know, he'll often be, you know, he and his family will be prayerful about certain events and, or certain decisions or their role in it. But the words of, as he said, you know, even in that letter that he sent out and some of the subsequent interviews he's done, you know, he fulfilled his duty to the Constitution. He swore an oath, so help him God, to defend and to support and defend the Constitution. And so I think that's where he views those things. And, you know, it's the interesting thing, you know, about, and regardless of what his future plans may be, the one thing that I know as it relates to, you know, to the former vice president is that, you know, he served next to President Trump by his side, you know, as one of his top, you know, spokespeople, champions, partners in the, you know, in that administration for 364 years and 364 days. There was one day, you know, obviously out of that time when, you know, when those paths diverged. So when you actually listen to when what he says, when he's on the stump, when he's giving a speech, and I don't see that it would be any different now than it would be going into the future. He spends the most of his time talking about the successes they had together and the policies and the results and the things that moved America forward.
But Mark, and, yeah, I heard that.
There is
I heard
the area
that.
Of disagreement.
I heard that last comment when he stood up. And in fact, I finally in myself thought to myself, he's finally standing up in his own world here when he talked about there's no room for pro talk about the Russian president in your party. And I thought to myself, okay. Now we're finally seeing a separation here. It's clear and it's distinct. I think it was needed. Do you?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, but I know, and, you know, we've dealt with this, you know, obviously since the days of, the, you know, when they first started vetting him for the vice presidency and then obviously all through those campaigns, you know, and you and I both know this as well too, Kevin. I'll use the example of, like, you know, just take the Indiana legislature or the, you know, or the U.S. Congress. 99% of the things that happen, you know, by nearly unanimous votes. It's really only the things that are where it breaks down, whether it's controversial, whether we have that really get covered usually, for the most part. Most of it is very, you know, matter of fact, everyone's moving together in the same page. So it's easy to focus on those areas where there is disagreement or where there is divergence. But I don't think we should overlook the fact that, you know, that so much of what he says and what they talk about is the areas where they were in agreement and where they were working side by side.
Last question about the vice president. You always seem to go through this dance, or maybe you call it a romance or whatever, but it's clear to me he's running, Mark.
Yeah, I don't know. Obviously, I don't know. You know, I think what he's doing, and he's doing this the exact way that we would have done this, you know, in everything prior. It, you know, whether it was for governor, whether it was for vice president. Obviously, what, you know, we know that everything is a series of steps, and that you have to do certain things. And when you achieve that first goal, you allow yourself to move on to the next goal. And if you don't do any of those things, then you're playing catch up later down the road. So what I think his focus, and I know it, I mean, we were just speaking about it, his focus is on 2022 and doing everything he can to help our candidates in 2022. He's laying groundwork. He's fundraising. He's doing all those things to put himself in a position next year to be able to say, I am in a position where I want to do it. I think I have something to deliver, and I think I have a pathway forward, so I can say yes, or I don't think it's going to line up for X, Y, and Z, so I'm going to say no. But if you don't do all those things first, you really don't have a choice but say no. So what? Right now, he's just doing all those steps, so he has the option to say yes or no when that time comes.
All right. Mark Lauder, the Chief Communications Officer for America First Policy Institute.
Mark, thank you very much. It's good to hear your voice again.
Great to talk to you
good
again,
to hear
Kevin.
You back on the stump here. I'm Kevin Rader. Focus on the Community is produced by DLC Media News Center. Tune in on Saturday at 6 a.m. at 104.9 and WAXI in Rockville, Clinton. You can stream at 104.9 WAXI.com. Saturday, 7 a.m. on WAMB AM 1130 and 106.9 in Brazil. And 99.5 at WAMB in Terre Haute. You can stream at WAMBRadio.com. On Sunday, 6 a.m. at 105.5 WVIG in West Terre Haute. You can stream at WVIGTheLegend.com. And Sunday, 7 a.m. at 92.7 The Rock WFNB in Brazil. You can stream at 92.7TheRock.com. And downloads are available via each station's website beginning on Monday morning. Thanks again to Mark Lauder. I'm Kevin Rader in for Dave Crooks. Have a great week.